Hey everyone, I want to thank you for indulging me this sermon. We've never done this before, like pre-record a message for both campuses. We may never do it again. But in this case, it just felt really appropriate. And let me explain why. We're wrapping up our series on the Great Commission. And we're talking about taking this gospel and making disciples of all nations. You know, it's the global component. It's looking at our mission, which, you know, is part of our mission is loving the world that Jesus, through his people, is working to restore. And we're just looking at that through the widest angle lens. And this is something that's near and dear to my heart because many of you know, I actually used to be a missions pastor. I've taken teams to various countries around the world. I myself have been to some of the darkest, most desperate places on the planet. And even to this day, here at Willowdale, of our pastors anyway, I'm the one who's most engaged with our global outreach. And so it's just one of those where it's like, I think I need to bring this message, and yet I'm in Dallas because of global outreach. And so we're doing it this way. So thank you for indulging me. And let me just give you a quick context to what we're talking about. In the course of this series, on the year of disciple making and on the call of disciple making, we've talked about this one aim, the one mandate of Matthew 28, make disciples. We talked about how it is backed by two assurances. Jesus says, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me, and surely I'm with you always to the very end of the age. You know, all we have backing us is the omnipotence and omnipresence of God. Other than that, we're on our own. And then we talked about the three actions. Last week, Johnny brought us a great message about going, baptizing, teaching. Well, today, it's 1,000 audiences. 1,000 audience. We're to make disciples of all nations. Now, I want you to think about this with me, and just starting with a story. I want you to imagine that in the icy waters of the North Atlantic, there's not just one giant cruise ship going down, but there's two. There's the Titanic, and a couple of miles away, there's the Gigantic. And they are both taking on water. They are going down fast. In fact, there are already passengers in the water from both ships. There's no way there's enough rescue boats for everybody. And so there is inevitably going to be some loss of life here. That's the bad news. The good news is you're on a rescue boat and you see both of these ships. Now, the Titanic's closer. The Gigantic's a solid 1,000 yards further away. And as you're looking at the Titanic, to your horror, you see this ship breach and break in half, and now everybody's in the water. And so you diesel your rescue boat right into the debris field, and you start bringing people in. And you and the crew are just working with all your might. People are flinging life rings and ropes and reaching hands into the water. Other people, as people are coming aboard, they're putting blankets on them. They're taking them below. They're tending to their wounds. Somebody's boiling water and making hot soup, and we got to take care of all these people. And it's an awesome rescue effort. There are lives, many lives being saved. There are, at the same time, many lives being lost. And there are many lives hanging in the balance. Truth matter is, you can work with all your might and save many, but even if somehow you could catch them all, your boat wouldn't even hold them all. But no matter, you're just focused on the task at hand. But then, while you're working on this crisis, you hear over the radio or from the loudspeakers coming across the water from the Gigantic, come over here and help us, somebody save us. And it's interesting because the voice has a very thick Arabic accent. And that's because, well, this cruise liner is from the United Arab Emirates. What do you do? Sounds like one of those middle school dilemmas, moral dilemmas. What do you do in this case? Well, think about this thing with me. If the only criteria for what to do is care and concern, I would suggest that we'd ignore the distress call. That sounds horrible. When is it ever right to ignore a distress call? And well, the answer is right here in this situation. where care and concern, all that you can handle is right here in front of you. All of these are, you know, precious souls. All lives matter. And we've got a lot of dying lives right here in front of us. And because this is more than we can manage, it just wouldn't make sense to go over there. In fact, there are probably some more logical and reasonable people who would say, no, that's exactly the right call. Because, I mean, think about it. You need concentration of force to win this war. And if you split off some of your people and now they have to row across 1,000 yards of icy water, their energies might be depleted when they get there. People are going to die in transit while you could be rescuing folks. There could be a language barrier there. There could be so much desperation over there that a couple of your little launch boats are just going to be overrun with people and the whole thing's going to capsize and everybody's going to drown. I mean, frankly, you might even worry about a little different kind of violence, you know, like when all these Arabs get on that boat, they might just kill you infidels and get more of their own on that ship. There are a lot of reasons and caring reasons, let alone some of those other concerns, why you would just fish out as many people right in front of you as you could. But now, what if part of the calculus here is not just care and concern, but is calling, is commission? Let's say a week or so ago before you went out on patrol, all the ship crews and captains stood before the fleet commander who said, now, you know all authority's been given to me, and I want to send you out on our rescue mission. And I want you to know, this is an international rescue mission. I want you to go out and I want you to rescue people indiscriminately. In fact, if you get yourself into a really crisis situation where, you know, you got some of your own kind here, but you see a need of some people that, you know, we might consider the other, I actually want you to give maybe a certain almost preferential treatment to them because our Father Creator, He made them all and He loves them all. And in fact, He so loved the world, that's why He sent me on the scene to rescue at least representatives of them all. And so, you see, we value not just maximum rescue, maximum disciples, but maximum diversity among the disciples. And so, no matter how critical the need right before you, don't get myopic. Pay attention. And if there are others who need you, especially who fall into the category of other, you're going to have to prayerfully and quickly consider a way that you can serve and save them too. Now, I would like to suggest to you that that's a little bit of at least the ethos behind the Great Commission. And that means that it might be a little bit complicated for us because what we can't do is just say, hey, we live in a lost world. We got a lot of people right here to reach and serve and help. Why would we care about over there? Well, because our commander who has all authority said, you know, I want you to make disciples of all nations. God deserves the worship of all the people that He made and of all the people for whom Christ died. So I want to define this commission just a little bit more as it pertains to all nations. I want to defend it briefly. And then I want to describe it. Like, what does it mean for us to engage? Now, just defining this commission. You know, Johnny told us last week that this participle, going, our translation says go and make disciples, it's actually going. That is, nevertheless, closely linked to the imperative, make disciples, so much so that it is part of the command. And that is exactly right. And maybe in some ways, my rescue boat illustration really bears that out. I mean, the mandate is rescue people. But the going is pretty well presumed. You've got ocean-going rescue ships. Get out there on patrol and rescue people. It wouldn't do any good to have somebody say, hey, you know what we ought to do? We're going to go tie this thing up. We're going to dock it by the beach, put our toes in the sand, have drink cozies, sit in our beach chairs, and whatever we can see as we scan the horizon from 3 feet above sea level, if we see somebody in need, we'll help them. No, no. If you have a rescue ship, it's assumed you're going to be going on patrol so that you can fulfill your mission. Well, likewise, the end of this mission, the object of it, all nations, that's not an afterthought either. go and make disciples of all nations. The Greek is panta ta ethne. Ethne. You know, we get ethnic group from it. And that's a big hint to what this means. You see, it's not just, hey, I want you to make sure that we get a few converts in every geopolitical nation on earth, because those boundaries change. No, it's, I want you to make sure that you are reaching out to every cultural and linguistic group on the planet. Numerically, it just works out like this. You know, right now, there are about 195 nations on earth. Depends whether or not you count Taiwan independently or not. If you do, it's 196. But there are about 17,000 ethno-linguistic groups, tribes, and nations. Kind of like the old Yugoslavia, right? Yugoslavia was one geopolitical nation. But hey, it's got Serbians and Croatians and Montenegrins and Slovenians and such. I mean, there are different people groups in there. Well, there are 17,000 of them on the planet. As of right now, about 7,000 of those are still not reached. And that's a big number. But that number has actually come down dramatically in our lifetimes. And missions experts are saying, this thing is finishable in this generation. In fact, you know what's really awesome about this? Let me give you a word here. Banchada. You know what that is? This is a tribal group in central India in the state of Madhya Pradesh who for 500 years have been trafficking their own daughters into sex slavery just to, you know, fund their lives. But now, with Bombay Teen Challenge, we have the unspeakable privilege of being a part of bringing the gospel to this unreached people group. So God willing, very soon, it's going to be 6,999 because we're going to take this one off the unreached group. And I know it's going to happen because Jesus said, I'm going to build my church and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. And so we are a part of this mission. This is what this mission is about. Now, let me just defend it, though, a little bit. And simply in this way, you know, there are some people, whether for ideological reasons or political reasons, or some actually almost like twisted theological reasons, say, this calling's not upon us. It's not incumbent upon us to do this. That was for the original disciples. Jesus took the 11 to the mountain and gave them this commandment. And, you know, that it may apply to some of us, but it doesn't apply to most of us. And I say, hey, wait a second. I can disprove that just from the text itself. Jesus said part of the Great Commission is teaching them to obey everything I've commanded you. I don't think he meant everything else I commanded you except this Great Commission to go and make disciples of all nations. You don't have to teach them to do that. Or take the very last line. Surely I'm with you always to the very end of the age. Kind of suggests that Jesus doesn't expect the original, you know, 11 or the 120 in the upper room, you know, at Pentecost to get this job done. Otherwise, he wouldn't be, you know, promising his presence to the end of history. But he does. And guess what? Nobody's lived at the end of history more than we're living right now. And as mission experts say, this thing is achievable in this generation. Who knows? But that we might be the last generation or among them on this earth before Christ's return. And so this mission is ours. And it's ultimately ours, not just because of one verse, you know, Matthew 28. It's because the whole Bible is riddled with the global mission of God. And the whole reason the Bible's riddled with it is because God himself is a missionary God. From Genesis 3, when Adam and Eve fell into sin and hid in the bushes, God came and said, "Where are you? We have a God who seeks and saves those who are lost." God commissioned Abraham, gave him really the original Great Commission. I want you to go from where you live to a land I'm going to show you, and I'm going to multiply your descendants, and I'm going to make you a great nation. And he says, through you, all peoples on earth will be blessed. They're all going to be blessed ultimately through you. And down through the ages, every epic of Bible history, the nations are a part of God's efforts. In the Exodus, when God brings the children of Israel out of slavery in Egypt, Exodus 12 tells us that, hey, a mixed multitude also went up with them. There were other tribes and nations already set free at the original Exodus, let alone what Christ effects. In Leviticus, you know, the law, when God establishes his people and gives them the law, he says, now you shall treat the stranger who sojourns with you as your native born. You shall love him as yourself because you were once foreigners and aliens in Egypt. I am the Lord your God. This is the third part of our own church's mission statement. We're loving the world that Jesus, through his people, is working to restore. When you come to the Psalms, in Psalm 96, you know, we're singing a new song to the Lord. We're declaring his glory among the nations. In Isaiah 49, this prophetic word, you know, it's too small a thing to just bring people from Israel, you know, back under God's grace. No, I'll make you a light for the Gentiles that my salvation may reach the ends of the earth. Now, Israel never lived up to their identity that way. But Jesus came, and where they weren't the light of the world, Jesus came and said, I'm the light of the world. And then he won followers for himself, and he said, you are the light of the world. And Jesus said, you know, I've got sheep from other sheep pens, not just here in Israel, and I've got to bring them too. And then he sent us to be a part of that rescue mission. He said, as the Father sent me, so I am sending you. He said in Acts 1:8, you're going to be my witnesses when the Holy Spirit comes upon you to the ends of the earth. In fact, the New Testament establishes us as a missionary people of a missionary God. 1 Peter 2:9, you're a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people belonging to God, that you might declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. That's just a brief rehearsal of some Bible passages, but I just want to defend the Great Commission as incumbent upon us to be part of it. I like what Christopher Wright, who's grew up a missionary and he's now a theologian, says. You know, it's not so much that the church has a mission. The mission has a church because God's a missionary God and he commissions a people to execute his play to redeem the world. So we've defined the mission, we've defended it a little bit, but now I want to describe it. What does it mean for us to engage? And I want to pick up on what Johnny used last week as kind of the particular and the general applications of this. And I want to start with the general, because there are many ways in which we can engage in this right here, right now. Whether you're ever called to be a, you know, cross-cultural missionary or not, at least in another land. Here's how we start. By being on mission right here. You know, if you ever get an email from me, I have this tagline. On a cruise ship, there are staff and there are customers. But on a rescue boat, everyone is crew. And that's the way we conceive of ourselves at this church. We're a rescue boat. We're not a cruise ship. Everybody's crew. And everybody has a piece of the action. Everybody together is a part of the rescue mission. I say this a lot these days too. You know, there are people in your neighborhood, in your workplace, that you work out with at the Y, that your kids are doing activities with, and they are far from God. They're far from God, but they're near to you. And why are you in that circumstance? But to be an agent of grace and reconciliation to them. So be on mission. A missionary is the old missionary slogan. The light that shines farthest shines brightest at home. And if we're passionate about the rescue mission here, oh, we're going to meet people and reach people like the Bunchadas and others as God gives us opportunity. But here's another thing we all need to do and we all can do. Pray. Pray our guts out on this thing. Listen, the New Testament describes conversion to Christ in these terms, using these analogies. It's like opening blind eyes. It's like unstopping deaf ears. It's like raising people from the dead. You know, Ephesians 2, you were dead in your trespasses and sins. Now, you tell me, how good are you at curing blindness, deafness, or raising the dead? I don't know about you, but I'm terrible at all three. But what's impossible with man is possible with God. And Jesus repeatedly told us all things are possible through prayer. We've got to bring it every day for people near and far who are far from God. We just keep banging on the door of heaven, keep banging on the gates of hell until those things fall. In fact, I heard a silly little story, but for some reason I like it. There was a woodpecker who used to sit on a thick tree and just peck at that tree trunk day in and day out. And it's a huge tree, and oh, he makes a little dent here and there. In fact, he creates a little hole, but he just keeps coming at it. And one day, there's a big, electrical storm, and there is a bolt of lightning, and it comes down and it shears that tree in half, from top leaf to bottom of the trunk. And that thing just falls open and lays open. And the woodpecker, I mean, he gets stunned by this thing. And he's kind of smoking, but he's alive. And he dusts himself off. And he looks at this thing, and he can't believe it. He goes, rounds up all his friends, and looks back and says, "Now look at this, boys. This is how it's done." Well, that's in some ways how it will go down with us and the mission of God. Now, we'll give him direct credit. We won't claim it for ourselves. But we keep banging on that thing and banging on that thing. And you know what? The fire falls. The lightning falls in response to those persistent prayers. So keep bringing it. Here's another one. We can all do this, especially if we have kids or work with children here. Start young. Start young. You might know Psalm 127 that talks about children are a heritage from the Lord, like arrows in the hands of a warrior are children born in one's youth. Blessed is the man whose quiver is full of them. Well, we have young children, and they are arrows. And the missionary hero and martyr, Jim Elliot, said this, "And what are arrows for but to be pulled back on the bowstring of faith and to be launched into God's global battle?" Do we think of our children that way? Do you think of yours, if you have children, that way? I try to think of mine like that. Like, if God calls them directly into the mission, like in missionary service, for example, I want to affirm that. I want to be for that. I don't care if it's risky or dangerous or they don't make enough money. If God calls them, I want to affirm them. And maybe if you happen to be around when we dedicated Justice, a few years ago, and she has this name, Justice. And I'm like, man, God, what if she could work for IJM? I'm down at their conference right now. What if she could work for International Justice Mission? It's their middle name, but it's her first name. I would love to just pull that bow back, the bow of faith, and release that arrow into God's mission. Are you willing to do that? Could you cast that vision before kids? I know of a church, they don't do baby dedications. They do what they call parent commissionings. And part of the commissioning vow is this: if God calls my child one day to a difficult mission field, I promise not to stand in the way, but to bless and encourage my child to follow God. That's awesome. We could have that ethos about our households and our church more and more. Here's another thing. Consider the fact that you may be called to go, or it might just be that God brings the world here. And I don't mean to get into the immigration debate right now, but I'm just telling you what you already know. The nations of the world are all around us. I remember, 15 years ago when we first moved here, I can't remember whether it was Kelsey's class or Krista's class, but we were at back to school night. And we met the other children and parents and the teacher. And there were 8 nationalities represented in that room. One family were the Siggies from Sweden, who used to be a part of our church. But there were 6 others besides we Americans that were there. And it's like, the world is at our doorstep. And you might not be called to go to, any given nation. But if you meet somebody from that nation and you're intentional about building a relationship and you share the gospel with them and you make a disciple out of them, who knows how many more people they're going to go back and they're going to win. It would be an awesome thing. And that, by the way, is also another thing we can be engaged in with some intentionality. Racial harmony and reconciliation. It's about a hospitable spirit toward every ethnic group, but especially to the places and with the people who, suffer the racial tensions that are just constantly a part of our life and our world. we, of all people, people of grace and of the gospel, ought to be able to be agents of reconciliation, to be intentional about certain relationships. If we have the opportunity to cross paths with somebody who is different from us, like, let me give that some special attention. God gave it some special attention. He has a certain intentionality by saying, go and make disciples of all nations. Maybe I can be intentional in this cross-cultural relationship. Yeah, I think you know that what happened in Antioch in New Testament times is just something that's so beautiful and I think so powerful for us. Let me just rehearse the story for you real fast. Antioch, the third largest city in the Roman Empire, sits at the end of the Silk Road, you know, from India and the Far East, and at the northwest corner of the Mediterranean Sea. Sits at the nexus of continents, you know, between Asia, just a little south of it is Africa, and Europe. It also happens to be, you know, where there are seismic plates. And Antioch, though it was huge, it suffered all kinds of problems. There were regular earthquakes, historians and archaeologists tell us there. There were floods. There were fires. There were at least three epidemics that swept through that city and wiped out probably each of them at least 25% of the population each time. And yet historians say that because of trade and commerce and everything else, there were no fewer than 17 distinct ethnic neighborhoods in Antioch. But they didn't get along. Not until the Christians came. The people who came with the gospel. And as Acts chapter 11 says, the disciples were first called Christians in Antioch because they crossed the cultural boundaries, because they engaged with people who were different from them. And Rodney Stark, who is a sociologist of religion, used to teach for years at the University of Washington. He's at Baylor University now. He writes this: any accurate portrait of Antioch in New Testament times must depict a city filled with misery, danger, fear, despair, and hatred. A city where the average family lived a squalid life in filthy and cramped quarters, where half the children at least died at birth or in infancy, and most children, if they lived to maturity, lost at least one parent. He says, a city filled with hatred and fear, rooted in intense ethnic antagonisms and exacerbated by a constant stream of strangers. And yet he says, but here and in other cities, Christianity revitalized life by providing new norms and new kinds of social relationships, able to cope with many urgent urban problems. To cities filled with the homeless and impoverished, Christianity offered charity and hope. To cities filled with newcomers and strangers, Christianity offered an immediate basis for attachments. To cities filled with orphans and widows, Christianity provided a new and expanded sense of family. To cities torn by violent ethnic strife, Christianity offered a new basis for social solidarity. And to cities faced with epidemics, fires, earthquakes, Christianity offered effective nursing services and benevolent care. Friends, you know and I know, nationally, especially we majority culture white evangelicals, our name is mud nationally. But it doesn't have to be that way locally. And I charge us all, as Christ commissions us to make disciples of all nations, let's be as intentional and as gospel opportunistic as we can be to set a different tone, to live a different life, and to extend the radical hospitality of the gospel, just as it's been extended to us. Well, that's all, at least some of the general ways that we can be engaged on the mission. But here's a particular one. Go. Go. What's stopping you? We have some young adults who are members of our church, Ryan and Melanie Gurman, who have gone to Southeast Asia, and they're translating the Bible into languages that have never had it before. That's an integral part of our people being reached with the gospel and churches forming up. By the way, let me just insert this. This is a beautiful thing, you know. Until recently, estimates were that we wouldn't get the scriptures into every known language until the year 2150. Because there are a lot of languages out there and translation work is hard. But then you know what happened? Three key mission leaders representing different translation ministries decided like, hey, why are we each playing in our own corner of the sandbox? Why don't we get together and see if we could cooperate more intentionally? You know, this is catalyzed because all three of them went to a foundation for money to try to fund translation work to the same people group. It was like, this is ridiculous. We got to get together. And so they actually started meeting where I am right now at the Dallas airport once a month just to build a friendship. And then out of that to strategize something like, how can we accelerate the work of translation? Well, you know what the estimate is now for when we're going to have Bibles in every language, at least parts of Bibles? Not 2150, 2033. 15 years from now and 117 years sooner than used to be expected. Because people are working together and because we get to have a piece of that action with Ryan and Melanie doing translation work. You know, Melissa, Al's wife, she's an American, she's an Anglo, but she lives in North Africa now, reaching people with the gospel. Tom and Lena Varghese are Indians, raised in America, but back in India serving with BTC. And so who knows who God might be saying, you know, tapping you on the shoulder, you're called, or you're called, or hey, you need to start investigating where you might be called. Go online to the Joshua Project. You can learn about every unreached people group on earth and start praying and humbly submitting your life to Christ saying, where you send, I will go. And as we shine brightly with the gospel here, may it shine through us to the uttermost parts of the earth. And God be with you this next week.